Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say he liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. When you drive between Milwaukee and Madison on 94, your eyes are not deceiving you if you see Texas Longhorn cattle on the south side of the highway right around Jefferson. What are they doing in Wisconsin? And why are they here? Well, joining us is John Kane from Raising Kane Farms. And we're going to talk about those Longhorns in just a little bit later on, John. But first, I want to talk about you because you grew up actually in Wauwatosa.
Correct.
How did you go from being a city boy to having a farm out in Jefferson?
Long story. My grandpa started a commission firm in the Milwaukee Stockyards. My dad worked for him, went to Marquette University, wanted to live in the city, and then he started his own stockyards out near Oconomowoc and started working there as a kid. So as children, we'd drive out there and work on the farm and come back and hang out in the city.
So you had sort of a dual life.
Oh, yeah. It still is. I live in Madison right now.
So city boy and farm guy.
Yes.
Tell us about the farm itself, because it isn't like you're a traditional farmer.
No.
What exactly are you, John?
So I'm a livestock broker. I buy animals and essentially I sort them by size or customer needs and then I sell them.
All right. So explain, why is there such a thing as a livestock broker? I think a lot of people think that cattle, sheep, they go directly from a farmer to a processor.
So say a farmer raises a herd of cattle or a flock of sheep, what have you. There's all sorts of makes and models, big ones, small ones, all different ages, young ones, old ones, and customers demand different types of animals. So what we do is we bring them in volume, sort them up per customer specification, and then sell them to the customers.
How do you sort them?
Mostly late at night. For instance, like a prime steer for a grocery store, they'll be 18 months old to 24 months old. And then you'll have different grades of them. Prime, choice, select. They'll have some utilities in there that aren't so good. So you sort them per quality and you have to know what you're doing there to figure that out on a live animal.
I was going to say, that must be pretty hard, certainly for most people, to look at a steer and say, okay, this is prime meat, this is choice, this is select.
So I have four brothers and sisters, and I'm the only one with the curse to be able to tell the difference between the different animals. You're sort of born with it, I think. It can be taught. I got a meat science degree from UW-Madison. Kind of just feel you have to grow up in it and understand the animals from a volume standpoint. You have to just see so many repetitions of animals, get the feedback. And the feedback is generally you might lose money, so you learn and refine and so forth. And I also had a meat business for 4 or 5 years as well. I learned a little bit there.
So you're looking at the steer and you can tell by what, the body build? Or?
Yeah, what its hips look like, what the backbone looks like, if you can see the ribs. My uncle, he was just an old school stockyards guy. He would walk up to these steers and feel their ribs, the intercostal muscles on the ribs. Are they filled with fat? Because sometimes the hide is deceptive. You know, in the wintertime, the hair is long, so an animal might look better than it actually is. So, yeah, people, you know, the old school guys would walk up and actually feel the ribs. Summertime, it's a little bit easier. I deal with a lot of sheep, so you have wool, so I have to feel them. Say the mother sheep is called a ewe, and generally people see a ewe. Well, they come in semi-loads of 300, and I have 11 different categories for my ewes alone. For my whole business, I have over 120 SKUs of different animals that I do, categories. It all comes back to the customer demand. What do they want?
So when you sort them, they're what, in different areas in your farm?
Yeah, they all come in on semis, come into holding pens, and then I just start working away and sort them one at a time into groups, and then depending on how many animals a customer would want, I fill up the pens, fill up the order, and ship them out.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
If you get the animals and you hope you get rid of them, you're just speculating.
Livestock broker John Kane reveals a trade secret.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with livestock broker, cattle dealer, John Kane from Raising Kane Farms. Who are your customers? Are they major manufacturers? Are they smaller places?
I have a really eclectic group of customers. So in the sheep and goat world, they would be a lot of either Islamic or Jewish customers, mostly for the lamb and the ewes, the mother sheep. Hogs, a lot of smaller places, generally Milwaukee or North Chicago for those. Cattle, I do more regional packers. The cattle industry is consolidated. There's really about four main packers in the world. Any auction you go to, or if you're a farmer, you only really have four choices of where you're selling your animals to. They hire their full-time buyers, and so there's not much opportunity to sell to these major packers. Back 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, there'd be hundreds of packers. So that's when competition was fierce, and that's when middlemen really had to be talented because there were so many different packers with different specifications.
So you have your various customers. They tell you ahead of time what they're looking for, or do you just keep moving in sheep and livestock and cattle and wait for those orders?
It's quite a balance. So what I do is fairly risky. So growing up in it, we had a tough time, and it was we got branded a couple times pretty good. So I actually had to leave when I was 18. That's why I went to the university, because I didn't think there was a future in it for me at all. I thought the consolidation of the industries would eliminate that position of being a dealer. So I went to school, and then I ended up working for the university for 10 years. And then after my dad died, I was kind of taking down his facility, taking his barns apart, and a couple of his customers, hey, as long as you're out there, would you mind getting me this and that? I said, ah, sure, I can do that. And it just kind of grew from there. And then we rebuilt the barns, and things are good. But what I am is a dealer. I take ownership of the animal. And I guess I'm getting old enough, I could probably let some of my secrets out. But one of my secrets that I learned from being a kid and how things turned out was I sell them before I buy them. So I get the orders, and then I go get the animals. Otherwise, if you get the animals and you hope you get rid of them, you're just speculating. These markets move every day. And, you know, and you got to feed the animals. A certain percent might tip over and die. You know, it's just a fact of life. You know, there's all sorts of expenses to holding animals. So what I do is try to have zero inventory by the end of the week. And that's how I've made it work for me. And then I go get customers. So it's on me to go get the animals. I'd rather have that risk than have the animals.
So you're looking at a weekly turnover.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned the consolidation.
Yes.
Of the major meat packing companies. When did that all begin? Like how many years ago did you start to see that?
It's sort of a slow burn, but I would say in the 80s. So for beef, we have four major packers: Tyson, Cargill, which are American companies, and then there's JBS and National Beef, which are Brazilian companies.
Uh-huh.
So if you're a producer here in the United States, you basically have one of four choices of those to sell to for the commercial beef. There's dairy cows, and those are killed by smaller regional packers. American Foods Group, JBS, does kill those. Two plants up in Green Bay. They're Green Bay Packers. That's where the name came from. But what that does is it pretty much flatlines prices. Back in the old days when there was a lot of different packers with a lot of different needs, so much more competition. If people were short, they'd pay X number of dollars over the market to get them bought. If they were long, they'd go under the market. Now it's kind of, what's the market going to be today? You know, it's pretty flatlined. It's not very exciting. I mean, it has fluctuated a lot, but there's not generally going to be one dog that's way out in front of the other ones. That doesn't happen anymore.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
You know, what is a product worth? It's what you can get a person to pay for it, right?
Cattle dealer John Kane explains exactly how beef prices have gotten so expensive.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with livestock broker John Kane from Raising Kane Farms. If we go to the store, is the beef that we purchase for the most part from the United States, or is it imported from other countries?
Mostly from the United States. I'm not an expert on this, but yes, mostly from the United States. And the United States does export a lot of beef, as a matter of fact, too. But we have the highest quality beef in the world, by far. And our consumers demand a really high-quality product. So the beef that's imported is generally more trim for burgers, specialty meats. It's hard to beat the U.S. when it comes to genetics and production and so forth. We're by far the best.
We keep hearing about this Wagyu beef. Is it from here or is it really from Japan?
I don't know much about it. There's just fads that come all the time. And I'm not saying Wagyu is that way, but it kind of, for a commercial guy like me, it a little bit has that feel. It's been so diluted. I mean, it was a lot of money for a Wagyu steak for so long. Well, then they could sell the Wagyu bulls for a lot of money. And then they started crossbreeding them with a Angus bull. And then it's a 50% Wagyu. You pay a little more. It's one of these heritage kind of niche deals. I don't pay much attention to it. I did go to Red Sushi in Madison a couple months ago and had a Wagyu tenderloin. It was to die for, is so good. But I don't know much about Wagyu, really. It's not – when you see the Wagyu animal and compare it to like a nice Angus steer versus a Wagyu steer, they don't look so good. They just kind of look like an average animal. Where sometimes Angus, when you look at them, they kind of look delicious. So the Wagyu, it's a really hard game. The thing about Wagyu is, and I'm not an expert, but I think it has a lot of intramuscular fat. That's the marbling that you see inside the steak. It's known for that. Like, it has a high percentage of marbling. That's how the USDA grades are. Prime is a lot of marbling. Choice is a little less marbling than that. And select is almost no marbling in there. So the Wagyu has even more than prime. And that is amazing because they're able to do that without having a lot of subcutaneous fat. That's the fat between the skin and the meat that you're basically trimming off the edge of your tenderloin or of your T-bone or porterhouse. It's that little peel there. So the Wagyu don't have a lot of subcutaneous fat, but they have a lot of marbling. It's like a magical animal, but it's such a small percent. Like, I can't say that I've ever sold one or bought or sold one. No.
Well, you mentioned the price of Wagyu beef versus, you know, a prime tenderloin. Why? And I think that's what most people are wondering. Why have beef prices particularly gone up so much just over the last couple of years? Why are we seeing such tremendous increases in the price of beef?
So there's four main reasons for that. The first one is consumer demand. You know, what is a product worth? It's what you can get a person to pay for it, right? And so we have fashionable diets, keto, the paleo diet. I read one study in 2019, I think it was 49% of Americans plan to add more protein to their diet. And then 2024, that was up to 61%. So we have a voracious appetite for protein overall. Now, why it's beef over pork, I don't know. I'd love to know that. But I'm guilty too. I went to the grocery store last night and there's a pork chop for $1.25. I could have got two of those. Instead, I went for the $12 steak. So the demand is the biggest reason. If people wouldn't pay it, it wouldn't cost as much.
Well, you're selling your steer for like $2.50 a pound, but is that a prime steer that you're selling for that?
I would say it'd be a high choice, like a choice steer. It could be a choice or prime. There's not a huge difference on the hoof because that's really hard to tell when the animal's live. You can guess pretty well, but it's really hard to get that. You really have to sell it to the packer and they will have a USDA grader there. The grader has it and it's like a prize in a Cracker Jacks. You get a little bit more for that animal if it grades prime. But it's hard to do until you get the animal slaughtered and hanging and actually look at what the loin looks like.
So when you move it on to the processor, how expensive is it for them to prepare that steer for the grocery store for us to buy?
I think that's one of the things that drove the consolidation because the big guys with the high quality equipment have a high efficiency so they can do it at scale. And the lower guys that don't have good equipment, it's always a technology that drives this consolidation. So the smaller guys are just at such a big disadvantage. So what does that cost per dollar? I can't really say, but it's very efficient for the big guys and not so efficient for the smaller ones.
Coming up at WTMJ Conversations.
We get probably 2 million a year from Mexico. I think we're down about 1 million.
Livestock broker John Kane reveals how a little Mexican worm has driven up beef prices.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with livestock broker John Kane. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Why have prices gone up so much if they've got this super equipment that can get this done and probably hiring fewer people?
A little in the parentheses, do you know that the Ford Motor Company, Henry Ford, went to a pork packing plant to watch how they take pigs apart in order to figure out how his plant should assemble cars? So it's like they'd start with the pigs way up on the fourth floor and let gravity control the processing. As the pigs come down to the third floor, they take this off. Down to the second floor, they take this off. So much bigger story is the drought. There's a drought in cattle country. Now, cattle country is South Dakota, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas. So there was a sustained drought in those areas from 2011 to 2012. You might remember that our corn was really small in 2012, short. 2012 was pretty bad. And what that led to was really a spike in beef prices in 2014 and 15. We went from boxed beef being like $1.90 to $2.10 a pound, and live cattle being maybe $1 to $1.20 live. After that drought, cattle spiked up to $1.70 live, and boxed beef went way up, I think, $2.50, $2.60 a pound. This last drought we've had, it was longer and much more severe. So cattle need grass to graze on if you're going to do it efficiently. They need the grass to graze on. Well, if there's no grass, you have to sell your cattle, because buying the feed and bringing it to the cattle, that's, you're going to go broke doing that. Feed's expensive. These animals are ruminant. They can turn grass into protein just with the four stomachs that they're born with. So that's what ranchers rely on, is vast swaths of grassland for these cattle to eat. So with the drought, they had to start liquidating their animals. And the drought may have ended this past year. Everywhere but Texas. Texas, that one flood around the 4th of July, they were dry before that, dry after that. It's still in drought conditions in what was the biggest cattle state in the United States. North Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, it's lush. So people can sustain their cow herds on that kind of grass. So why did it go up? People had to liquidate, and there's less cows. The cow herd right
now
is—
Wait a minute, but if they're liquidating—
It did drop the prices.
Yeah, okay, so prices went down, but now they don't have as many cattle, so that's why prices
don't have as many cattle. We have the lowest cattle herd in 75 years, and I think they started keeping records 75 years ago, so it might be more than that. So it's a severe shortage of cattle that has caused this. Big time. And we've watched it. You know, it was just when you watch the markets, you think it can't get higher. It can't get higher. And then those prices are just turned out to be child's play. You know, it got right now $2.50 a pound. It spiked to $1.70 in 2015. I never thought we'd see prices like that again. That's going to be $1.70 is going to be the high water mark for the rest of my life. We're at $2.50 now, mostly because of the drought. I mean, it's fantastic demand, but I would say, you know, I wouldn't put a percent on it, but it's the majority of the problem is the drought that we've sustained.
So what's next? I mean, if you're surprised at the prices and
shocked.
You've been doing this for years.
Yeah. But I wish my uncle was still alive. I'd love to see the look on his face if he knew what cattle were bringing. So there's one more factor, and that is a parasite called the New World screwworm that was detected first in southern Mexico. So the United States imports a lot of what we call feeder cattle. So a calf is born. Say these cows are born in Mexico. And then you wean them off the mom and you put them in a feed lot. So you call them feeder cattle. Well, we get probably 2 million a year from Mexico due to this screwworm parasite. It lays larvae in open wounds in any sort of animal, but we have closed the border to Mexican feeder cattle. And so since May 11th, I think we're down about 1 million feeder cattle coming from Mexico to be finished and slaughtered in the United States. So that's another factor. It was really bad timing for that screwworm to pop up and for us to close our border. Pretty necessary to close the border, in my opinion. Really risky to open it. So those are the main factors. One thing that has actually mitigated the prices, like they could be higher, is packers now, they'll accept larger cattle. So cattle, the maximum used to be 1,600 pounds, and then you get penalized for having a carcass over, you know, 800 pounds, 850 pounds, 900 pounds. The average carcass weight 2 years ago, I think it was 903. the average carcass weight today is 949. So that's a 5% increase. And I did the math last night, and that's the equivalent of 800,000 cattle extra meat that we have. So that's one thing that's actually mitigated this. If the packers were still demanding the old standard of what they used to want, we'd have higher prices.
Is the quality of meat affected by the size of the cattle?
It tends to get better. The older the animal, you just got to make sure they don't age out. Because of BSE, back in 2001, we have a law that you can't cut through the bone of an animal that I believe is more than 30 months of age. You have to actually bone it out. You can't saw through the bone. That's the law they came up with after BSE. So most cattle are harvested about 24 months of age. These bigger ones, they're kind of pushing 26, 27, 28 months of age, but they'll lay down more of that intermuscular fat. So you'll have a higher percentage of prime.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I think that will depend on the consumer. Like, what are they going to be willing to pay?
Livestock broker John Cain tells us his predictions for the price of beef.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with John Cain. He's a livestock broker and also the operator of Raising Cain Farms. What do you see, as somebody who's been in this business as long as you have, prices of cattle becoming? And is it going to get worse before it gets better?
Yes.
How much worse?
I think that will depend on the consumer. Like, what are they going to be willing to pay? I think there was some resistance published in September that consumers finally have plateaued on the price they're willing to pay for beef. I don't know if that's true or not. We'll see. But it takes, from the time you breed a cow or a heifer, 36 months to have a steak on your plate. So what has to happen first is we have to have moisture in the grassland in the cow-producing neighborhoods, you know, sustain moisture to give these people an incentive to hold back cattle. They have to breed them, go through the gestation period, and then raise them, which takes 18 to 27 months to raise them. But what has to happen there is you have to retain heifers. You have to retain the younger females to be the future cows. Right now, the incentive is just to sell them because there's not much grass and these $250 a pound, just sell them and be done with it. Why worry about work? Do what you're doing now. It's profitable. Why worry about work down the line if you can take the money and, you know, bird in the hand is better than two in the bush, right? So they'll sell the heifers right now. So they have to have substantial incentive to hold back their heifers out of the market and actually do the work. So say everything goes the way it always has and there's grassland, grass in the cattle country. We got, you know, maybe 36 months from now. Or they started retaining heifers this past summer, and you can tell by the makeup of the receipts and the auctions. Like if it's 50-50 steers and heifers, nobody's retaining heifers. But if you go to an auction and it's 75% steers, 25% heifers, you know farmers are retaining heifers.
So you're saying it's a good 3 years before we're going to see any relief in beef prices?
On the supply side, yeah. On the demand side, we'll see. So, you know, the beef market always kind of moves with the U.S. economy. And so, yeah, it really does. Because when people are doing well, they eat beef. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a direct correlation between the health of the U.S. economy and the health of the beef market. So I would say, you know, if we'd have a collapse in the U.S. economy, then we'll have a collapse in the beef market, but we'll have bigger issues to worry about at that point. You know, we'll definitely switch over to pork and chicken if that happens. But yeah, there's a direct correlation there. Like a year ago, I was talking with a friend of mine at the university, and they're getting into crossbred calves and so forth and researching crossbred calves. And he was wondering about, you know, marketing and so forth. And I thought the only thing that's going to really do it would be a collapse of the U.S. economy. So, I mean, within the next 3 years. Yeah, that's, I mean, all things, if things go how they always have, I mean, you just can't speed up that production. So there is one thing happening now, a new technology, and technology always changes these things. So we have dairy cows here in Wisconsin. I don't think we're any longer the leading dairy producer. That might be California or Texas, either one. But what we've done is dairy cows traditionally produce milk, right? And then in order for them to produce milk, they have to lactate. So they have to give birth, and then we take the calf away and take the milk. That's what happens. So that's sort of a substandard beef animal, and they would keep the females for replacement cows. Well, technology stepped in 6-7 years ago, or maybe longer, and they have sexed semen now. And so you can determine what sex animal will come from a batch of semen. You can sex the semen. And so if they want a female calf to replace that dairy cow, they'll take that kind of semen inseminate the cow and get the female that will then be a good milk producer. And these cows produce so much milk per animal. They're fantastic milking machines. But then the males, well, a Holstein steer, poor feeding efficiency. They take a long time to grow. Well, the meat's pretty good, but they're just not very efficient or sought after. So what they've done now is they've taken Angus semen and put it on these dairy cows. And they were trying to figure – inseminating these dairy cows. So they were trying to figure out how to get the right bulls to match with these dairy cows. And it took a couple of years. You know, there's a few donkey-looking animals in there. Now they're pretty slick-looking. So we, in effect, are having dairy cows – I don't know the exact number, somewhere between 25% and 50% of all offspring out of a dairy cow is now going to be a beef animal. And they're beautiful. So that's something that could help, but that's been going already for a few years in the midst of this price inferno. So I don't see it as making a difference. It actually probably would have been worse if they didn't come along and do that. But again, it all comes down to the consumer.
So
what are they going to pay?
We may end up seeing more cattle that will be produced for beef here in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's already happening. So you used to go to an auction, there'd be so many animals that were black and white. Now, most of the Angus cattle are black. So now you go to an auction and most of them are just black.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
He's just a little troublemaker no matter what. There's about 10 missed calls. Oh.
John Kane from Raising Kane Farms tells us the story of the great Texas Longhorn escape.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is livestock broker John Kane. Got to talk to you about your cattle. And I think that we started by saying, if you drive down 94, you look on the south side as you get around Jefferson, and you're going to see these Texas Longhorns. These are your pets.
They are my pets, yeah.
How did this all come about, John?
Someone probably dropped me on my head when I was a kid. I don't know, but it was a childhood dream. I don't know. I think I saw one in a magazine when I was a kid, and we just don't have them here in Wisconsin. I thought, oh, that's cool. I want to have that when I grow up. So I don't need a fancy car or a big house, anything like that. I just wanted my longhorns. And I was at a sale at Johnson Creek, Wisconsin, and this was not long after my dad died, and I was just kind of tinkering around at his place. And there was a heifer that came through the ring, and she cost 60 cents a pound. I think she weighed about 600 pounds. I bought her. I got my first longhorn, and it turned out she was pregnant and then had a calf, and then that was pretty fun. And I was still working at the university in those days, so it was a spur-of-the-moment purchase, and I thought I'd just have it for a little while. And then as the business stabilized and grew, people knew I had longhorns, and if they have a longhorn they call me, and you know, some I'll take and some I don't really want. And
How many do you have now?
Do you want one?
No, I'm just wondering.
Because I'm looking to offload a couple. Right now, I think there's 22 or 23.
Now, when we talk longhorns, describe how long those horns actually are.
My longest one, I would say, would be an 8-foot wingspan on there.
The horns?
The head and the horns, just from tip. They say tip to tip when they measure them. So, but yeah, my alleys are 8 feet wide, and when the cattle run down the alleys, they have to turn their head to the side to avoid hitting me.
Are you afraid at all? I mean, because those horns look dangerous.
They can be. I'm a big fan of treating animals like well. When I was working at the university, I worked for a wonderful monogastric nutritionist. Really gave me a lot of opportunities, and I always had an interest in animal behavior. So I got to work with some animal behavior bigwigs and think a lot about animal welfare, state of well-being for animals and so forth, and how you treat them. A lot is how they perceive you. So I always try to be predictable around them. I go out in the field with them, and I have one, that original cow I have. I still have her, and I can go out and scratch her back. And scratch her head and scratch her back. And, you know, if she's laying down and I have a coffee and I need to make some phone calls, I can sit on the ground next to her and put my back against her and drink my coffee and make my phone calls, which no one knows I'm probably doing on the other end of the line. But I would say she's a bit of a liaison animal where the other animals see her and myself interacting peacefully. And they're just mellow. They come around and smell me. And yeah, so I'll buy a new one here and there, and it takes a little while for them to trust and acclimate and get used to it, but they all seem to.
Do they have different personalities?
All of them, yeah. They're very interesting.
How do you mean?
Just whether they're timid, there's a pecking order for eating, how they interact with each other. You know, some are bullies, some are passive, some speak softly and carry a big stick. And I have this one, actually have a mini Zebu Brahma bull, and his name is Otis, and he's all of 400 pounds, and he's got a bit of a Napoleon complex. So he's the smallest one out there, but he's sure the loudest. He's trying to intimidate all the other ones, and they kind of give him a side eye and laugh at him. But he's just like a little bulldog out there. So he's quite a personality. I actually lost him in a bet to my brother. I bet my brother that he couldn't teach his cat to sit on command in 3 days, and he did it in a day. So now my brother owns Otis.
But you keep him.
I keep him, yeah, of course, yeah. Own him on paper and in his heart.
Tell us about the night the Longhorn escaped.
Which night?
This has happened more than once?
It's happened on occasion. So I had a sort of a naughty one. He was born there. This is black and white calf, and he was always – he's just a little troublemaker no matter what. But he decided he was going to – my place is located right on the interstate, as you mentioned. And he thought the grass was greener on the other side of the fence, so he jumped out. And they never do this at a good time.
He jumped over the fence.
Yeah, yeah. Though they can really jump. Yeah, I have a what they call a hot wire, so electric wire on the top. My fence in those days were not so good. We fixed that right after this incident. But yeah, I was sleeping and I had my phone silenced, but it was vibrating so much it woke me up. And all these 920 area codes, 674, that means Jefferson in Jefferson County, and that's the cops. There was about 10 missed calls. And yeah, he was out. So I give that sheriff.
Did you get him back or did
the sheriff did. I give him so much credit because my thing is as much as I love them, they're animals and I don't want anybody, you know, would never want to have anybody get hurt. So I just tell the sheriff, I'm like, put him down. You know, if it comes, you know, he's on the interstate, put him down. And they're hesitant to do that to their credit. And so to this guy, they're intimidating animals and well, these cops do use my place as a speed trap sometimes, so they're somewhat familiar with them, but they never interact with them personally or up one-on-one. And he herded it back, and then cattle don't want to be alone. They're a herd animal. They just won't go wandering off. So I think my animal wanted to get back in the pasture as well. So with a little encouragement from the sheriff, he popped in. So yeah, I drove out there. I don't know, it was midnight, 1 a.m, something like that. And he was back in there, and I actually had a semi there, and there was cops all over the place, and they said, no sweat. That's I had another incident where a person let some of my animals out on the road. We had kind of a weird person hovering around in those days. This person let animals out, and a person actually hit one of my steers. My only ticket, or I wouldn't say the ticket, in Jefferson County was for loose livestock on the road.
Well, all right. So you have these as pets. You are still conducting your business as a livestock broker. What's the future for you? Do you intend to do this forever?
Oh, it's funny. I was thinking about that. You're kind of born into it and you die out of it. And so at different times, I think of kind of ending it and doing something else. And, I was talking to a friend of mine and he was saying, well, you've been out there since you were 10. I'm like, no, I've been out there since I was like 3 years old. I remember feeding baby bottle calves when, you know, you have to hold these jugs up so the gravity is pulling the milk down. And these little baby calves are so tall, I had to be on my tiptoes with my arms like this. So I've done it as long as I can remember. I did take a break for 10 or 15 years to go to school and then work at the university, probably 15 years. But it'll be interesting. It will never leave my heart, you know. So growing up here in Milwaukee, my parents wanted me to play with other kids on the block, which I loved doing. But I loved being at the farm and going to auctions. It was always exciting. And when they'd make me stay home, I'd pull out my trucks and my little animals and I'd have auctions and load trucks and so forth. So now as an adult, I do what I played
as a kid, and like, how much better does it get than that? And when I was gone at the university for 15 years, I really missed it. So I feel like I can leave on my own terms, which, you know, a lot of people go broke and, you know, so forth, or things don't go well. So I think I've got it to a point where I can leave on my terms if I want to. But we'll, if I do, we'll keep the Longhorns around and keep having the firework shows and so forth. So, yeah, that'd be about it. Hopefully I keep doing it. I could be – it's hard work. This sorting is hard work, and it's mostly done at night. So, you know, social life kind of interrupts that quite a bit. I could see doing this in a more moderated fashion, just being maybe a cattle buyer or something. But we will see.
John Kane, Raising Kane Farms. Thanks for joining us
today. Thanks, Liv. You really appreciate it.
We've been talking with livestock broker and the owner of Raising Kane Farms, John Kane. He explained why beef prices have gotten so high and if he ever thinks they're going to go down. He also told us about his own hobby of raising Texas Longhorn cattle. You've probably seen them along I-94 in Jefferson. Now, if you joined us late and you'd like to hear our entire conversation with John, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.